This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Military juntas have really taken sort of an aggressive stance towards France. They've really appealed to sort of anti-French sentiment within the populace, anti-imperialism, and they're using that as a political tool for themselves.
That's Sahel expert Daniel Izenga on why Burkina Faso's military has ordered the French defense attaché to leave. Details coming up. Also, the death toll from Libya's flooding has hit an estimated 11,000. And the focus in Morocco's devastated earthquake zone is shifting to rebuilding homes and lives. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Burkina Faso's military junta has ordered the French embassy's defense attaché, Emmanuel Pasquier, to leave the country due to what it calls subversive behavior. A statement yesterday said Pasquier and his staff have 2 weeks to leave. Daniel Izenga, senior fellow at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies and an expert on the Sahel, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that France-Burkina Faso relations have deteriorated significantly in recent months after the West African country went through two military coup d'etats last year.
Burkina Faso had two military coups in 2022, the first in January and the second at the end of September 2022. So we're coming up on 1 year since that one. And these military juntas have really taken sort of an aggressive stance towards France. They've really appealed to sort of anti-French sentiment within the populace, anti-imperialism. And they're using that as a political tool for themselves. So they can mobilize people in the streets using France as a scapegoat and try and pump this sort of populist narrative of sovereignty and nationalist pride. And that kind of gets people mobilized and generates political support for the juntas. And the reason that they need that political support is because they're performing so badly on the battlefield. If you look at the number of violent events by militant Islamist groups in Burkina Faso during this roughly 18-month period that juntas have been in power, they've almost tripled when compared to the 18 months before the juntas came to power. We've done some research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies that looks at the geographic spread of militant Islamist violence in Burkina Faso, and it's really troubling. We see that it's actually almost doubled in terms of just the territory that's being affected by this violence. And even more troubling, we've seen that the militant Islamist groups seem to be pursuing a strategy of trying to cut off urban centers. So they're surrounding, heavily populated areas, cutting off major transit routes. And really, they've been able to completely almost encircle the capital of Ouagadougou, which is right in the central part of the country.
You talked about the pumping up the public to kind of rally behind the junta to say, France, leave our country. It's your fault. We're having all these problems. But is it really a situation these days now where they have to do much pumping up? I mean, it seems to be that there's a lot of sentiment that is anti-French in the country right now anyway.
Sure. And so, France has a colonial legacy in Burkina Faso and has not always been viewed by the public particularly positively. So it's not hard to kind of, gin up that anti-French sentiment. And certainly that's been a major objective, not only of the juntas in Burkina Faso, but also in neighboring Mali and neighboring Niger. We saw this military coup in Niger in July. I think it was not quite 2 months ago now. I think we're a little bit past 45 days since the latest military coup in Niger. And, that junta has done the same kind of thing. They've taken note of how easily this worked in Mali, how easily this worked in Burkina Faso, that they can kind of turn public opinion against France and then benefit from that themselves politically. And, the French position against all of these military coups has become increasingly hardened. There's no legitimate claim when you conduct a military coup that you somehow can then become the legitimate political power. And so in Niger, France has taken a really hard stance against the junta to say, no, we don't recognize you. You're not the legitimate president. The president, Mohamed Bazoum, is democratically elected. He's a civilian leader, and he's the legitimate president. And they've done so at times in, you know, slightly flagrant ways. And I think that the juntas see that as an opportunity to build political support for themselves, because they can then turn it around on France and say, get out of our politics. You don't have a role here any longer. And yeah, people are sympathetic to that.
That's Daniel Izenga, senior fellow at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies and an expert on the Sahel. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Damme here in Washington today. Libyan authorities limited access to the city of Derna today to allow searchers to dig for 10,000 people missing and feared dead from Sunday's flood. The Libyan Red Crescent estimates the current death toll at more than 11,000. Libya's two opposing governments, long divided by civil strife and war, have struggled to respond to a disaster of such great proportions. The United Nations aid chief said today Libya needs equipment to find people trapped, as well as primary health care to prevent disease outbreaks. Martin Griffiths said in Geneva the UN Humanitarian Office has sent a disaster coordination team of 15 people to Libya, and he said it could be a viable option to bring aid to Derna, a Mediterranean port by sea. Families in Morocco's high Atlas Mountains are still burying their dead a week after a 6.8 magnitude earthquake killed at least 2,900 people and injured more than 5,500. Hopes of finding survivors under the rubble are fading. Lisa Bryant reports from Atlas Mountains.
If there's a bright spot after this earthquake, it's the kindness of strangers. Moroccans donating truckloads of clothes and other basics to survivors. Fatma El Makra and her family are among those survivors. Like many others, they lost everything. She says about 20 people died in her village, including a neighbor hit by a rock as he tried to save his wife. She says when the disaster happened, they left everything behind and ran for their lives. Driving here is frightening. Steep cliffs, rock slides potentially triggered by aftershocks. One reason why aid was slow to get here. Now some international rescue workers are leaving, like Swedish firefighter Klaus Ola Kohlberg.
We have tried to work with the dogs to search for living persons, and so far we haven't found anyone.
Many still alive are now homeless, like the family of Naima Azmil, who are having tea this morning. She says right now they have food, clothes, and shelter, but they're living day by day. They don't know about the future. That's a feeling here shared by many. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Emin Sili, Morocco.
Sudan is mired in a brutal conflict that has raged in for 5 months, claiming thousands of lives and uprooting millions from their homes. To gain more insight into the origins of this crisis and potential solutions, we are joined today in studio by Sudan expert Holid Hare, the founding director of the Khartoum-based think tank, Confluence Advisory. Welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Thank you.
So what is this Confluence Advisory, the think tank you founded?
It was intended to work on policy-based or evidence-based policymaking during the transitional period, working on governance, peace and security, and the economy. We have since had to sort of reshape how we work after we were evacuated from Khartoum, and therefore looking to...
Okay, so we have fighting between two generals, or you can say two warring factions, who have plunged Sudan into a dark hole where there is no end in sight. Talk to us a little about, as a Sudanese, it must be devastating. How do you feel?
I think this conflict, unlike or more than any other conflict that we've had, bearing in mind Sudan has had a very long history of conflict. But this conflict is going to indelibly change the political and social landscape of Sudan. The social fabric within the country has been torn apart in a way that I don't think we've seen in any other context to the same extent. Sudan has had two civil wars. Both have lasted on average around 20 years. We've had, of course, the Darfur conflict that started in 2003 and is still ongoing. And this war seems like it potentially followed the same historical trajectory. And that's because at its heart, this war is about a power struggle between two factions of the same military project in Sudan. And this is the military project of ousted President Omar al-Bashir. And this project is now, this military is now effectively at war with itself. But neither side has the full gamut of military options available to it because they're effectively the two, you know, two separate parts. So it's difficult to see how either one of them can gain enough of a military advantage to pursue a full victory. What this means is that we're likely to be in some kind of stalemate that is very hurting, not for the two sides, but for the civilians that are being caught in this for quite some time.
So what do we do moving forward? I mean, this is a stalemate, the way you're talking about it.
I think the key needs to be to focus on the protection of civilians. The UNITAMS, the United Nations Integrated Mission in Sudan, was founded during the transitional period, but it does have some aspects of the mandate which are useful now, specifically looking at the protection of civilians element. And that means that the United Nations can put together protocols or practices that would ensure that there are safe zones for civilians and that they are not targeted as much by the two warring sides. And that's because there are two, if you can, it's helpful to think about it as two simultaneous wars that are going on. There's one that we see very clearly between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces. And then there's the war against civilians. And that war is being waged by both the Sudan Armed Forces and the rapid support forces on civilians. And the idea there is that whomever comes on top militarily and politically will therefore then face less pressure from a sort of demoralized and trodden upon public.
This war you're talking about, war against civilians, let's talk about maybe the gender-based violence that's happening over there. A spike in sexual violence.
Absolutely. And this is not, again, looking at Sudan's previous conflicts, of which there have been many, this is absolutely part and parcel of the playbook of the Sudanese military and the factions that it has spawned. We have seen gender-based violence used, and specifically rape, used as a weapon of war. Just recently, human rights monitors have been documenting about 28 or so teenagers who crossed from Darfur, the rest of western region of Sudan, into neighboring Chad. And those 28 teenagers were all pregnant as a result of the rapes that they had endured in Darfur because of this conflict. Now, obviously, they are not able right now to get the level of support that they need in terms of rape kits, in terms of psychosocial support, and they will have to live with the results of this harrowing abuses that they face for a long time, almost without help. That is a very, very desperate situation. And the international community should now be looking not just at documenting these crimes, but helping to prevent them too.
Holud Heer, the founding director of the Khartoum-based think tank, Confluence Advisory, thank you for your input.
Thank you.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is widely expected to run for a third term in next year's election, although he has not announced his candidacy. The only candidates campaigning so far, Ahmed al-Tantawi this week, denounced what he called harassment by the security forces against his supporters. Tantawi took to social media to say security forces had arrested, detained, and that many of his supporters had disappeared, and that six of them remain in custody. Sisi, the former army chief, took power in 2013 when the military ousted Islamist president Mohamed Morsi. He was elected president in 2014 and again in 2018, both times by overwhelming majorities. International rights organizations say Egypt has detained thousands of political dissidents over the past decade. Saeed Sadiq is professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about Tantawi's allegations and the prospect of any significant political change in Egypt.
So far, officially, he is not a candidate, but informally, he is working on a campaign to present himself as a presidential candidate. Why there is this harassment? Due to the rising economic crisis in Egypt, sit back in Egyptian foreign policy, like what we are seeing with the Ethiopian dam, like the declining regional status of Egypt. The popularity and the public trust in the regime are declining, thus feeding the growing negative, punitive voting bloc that seeks an alternative replacement candidate to challenge Sisi. So far, no one has appeared on the public scene to challenge Sisi but Tantawi, who is not, by the way, enjoys the unified support of the opposition groups in the country. This explains, however, why the government has become less and less tolerant of him and his backers and his whereabouts. So they began to harass him because so far he is the only vocal voice against Sisi, and he is the only one who appears to be serious candidate. The others are not taken seriously by the public opinion and the potential voters.
But could the next presidential election bring any political reform in Egypt?
Unfortunately, the internal balance of power upon which the regime rests consists mainly of conservative forces, particularly the deep state, which enjoys its current privileged status and does not favor any change that would undermine their power. So the idea of reform after the elections, even if Sisi is elected, seems unlikely after 10 years of his rule. The only chance that you will have a real change is that there is a big change in the ruling political elite, which is not foreseen for the time being.
How Egypt could move from the choice between Islamists and the army taking over? Is there a way out?
We need a transitional regime that would prepare the country through a new constitution about separation of power, checks and balances, like in the United States, that the army becomes an army, professional only technically, and not be involved in politics. But this should be a gradual process, not a sudden change, because this cannot happen. The Islamists have also learned that they cannot impose their views on the entire society. They cannot change laws because they want to apply certain ideas. They have to understand that not everybody shares their ideas and ideology. And this requires, again, also gradual change in the education system, in the media system, in the religious discourse. Democracy is a gradual learning historical process. It is not a sudden magical pill the society would take and the next day we are a Nordic democratic society. This takes time. And the only hope for us is a transition period with a program, with a set timeline, and then we can reach, in the end, a modern democratic state.
That was Saeed Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1. Then 202-258-3076.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is a committed partner in strengthening the international justice system that seeks to advance accountability for war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. Accountability for these crimes is key to a durable peace following conflict, said U.S. Ambassador at Large for Global Criminal Justice, Beth Van Schaack.
The whole field of transitional justice, which embodies a mix of judicial and non-judicial measures, formal and informal measures, and retributive and restorative justice measures, all provide a set of tools for societies emerging from armed conflict or oppression to address legacies of mass violence, authoritarianism, or impunity, to comprehensively rehabilitate survivors and their communities after violence, but also to engage in truth-telling, to engage in mechanisms of non-recurrence and other institutional reforms that will prevent a recurrence of conflict in the future.
Ambassador Van Schaack said the United States builds partnerships with like-minded states and encourages the adoption of inclusive and comprehensive transitional justice programs in states emerging from conflict or repression.
The last decade has seen incredible innovations in this field. The institutional framework is increasingly decentralized and multipolar. And while the International Criminal Court is an important element of this larger system, there are justice activities happening elsewhere at the domestic and international levels.
States are taking it on themselves to adjudicate cases of international crimes in their own courts where they have jurisdiction, Ambassador Van Schaack noted. National war crimes units are increasingly coordinating among themselves to share evidence, strategies, information, and arrest operations. States have also expanded their use of sanctions and import-export regulations to hinder bad actors from perpetuating, funding, or benefiting financially from their crimes.
Non-governmental organizations, many of them who are funded by the U.S. State Department, have emerged as important players in these proceedings. These organizations, which are often survivor-led, are collecting and evaluating potential evidence in real time, pursuant to international standards, to inform accountability processes.
The importance of good documentation cannot be overstated because it will undergird any justice efforts that might be underway, said Ambassador Van Schaack. While the international justice architecture is growing stronger, atrocities tragically keep occurring. The United States Ambassador Van Schaack pledged will continue to work with like-minded states, survivors, and civil society to document the crimes and forge just approaches that bring perpetrators to account.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.